And now, The Low Post.
Welcome to The Low Post Podcast, live from a small studio in our Seaport facility in New York City, New York, where we are about 5 hours from tip-off of the Porzingis Bowl. God knows what is going to happen by tomorrow morning when some of you will listen to this podcast. And in honor of the Porzingis Bowl, it is time to say the three most important words in niche NBA basketball podcasting. What up, Beck?
What up, Zach? Wow, this is different. I'm disoriented. This is very disoriented. I'm used to being in your spacious, cavernous studio on the Upper West Side.
It no longer exists. It's gone.
It's gone?
It's gone.
Wow. Wow, pour one out for the old studio.
You know what else might be gone pretty soon?
Wow, look at that segue. By the way, I'm going with Porzingapalooza as opposed to the Porzingis Bowl. I like a good palooza.
I just like bowl because you can use it's like it can also be toilet bowl. Like it also could be a it also could be. I used to call when the Nets and the Knicks were both bad. I would call that game the toilet bowl.
Yeah, appropriate.
So you were on the Knicks beat for how long?
17,000 years. It only felt that way. The better part of 9 years. It was 8 straight. I went over to the Nets for their debut in Brooklyn for a few months. The Times wanted me to go because it was a momentous event to have sports, pro sports back in Brooklyn. And then about halfway through the season, people got bored of the Nets and the Knicks were on their way to what was at, as we now know, their best season in a 20 year span, the 54 win year. And so I went back. So, the better part of 9 seasons.
Yeah. Well, here we are. Do you feel like you've never left?
I mean, I never left New York, so like the Knicks are never far from my gaze, I guess. Or you know, and besides that, you and I, we live here. We are surrounded by tortured Knicks fans, which is a redundancy in itself because all Knicks fans are tortured.
So let's discuss the Kristaps Porzingis game. On January 30th of this year, the Knicks traded Kristaps Porzingis, Tim Hardaway Jr., Courtney Lee. And I think that's it because I've stopped caring at that point.
Yes.
To the Dallas Mavericks for 2 future first-round draft picks, 2021 and 2023, Dennis Smith Jr., who, you know, he's gone through some personal tragedy, but before and after that, he just looks like a completely broken basketball player. Wesley Matthews, once a Knick, always a Knick. And DeAndre Jordan, the lead recruiter for Kevin Durant and Kyrie Irving, who helped recruit them to the other team in New York. Now Porzingis plays the Knicks tonight. Let's also review this. The Knicks are 2-9. They are the worst team in the NBA other than the Warriors, who are a G League team with a couple of good players. And after loss number, I believe, 7 of those 9, or 8 of those 9, Steve Mills and Scott Perry, the president and general manager of the Knicks respectively, held an impromptu or were coerced into an impromptu news conference in which they said, well, we just felt it was time to address you guys, the media. 10-game mark. Let's do a temperature take. I hope they do it every 10 games.
That would 20 be fantastic.
20-game mark, let's do a temperature take. Which certainly seemed like the coach is next if things don't change press conference. What are we to make? I don't even know where to go. What are you expecting tonight? What are you expecting going forward? How did we get here? I just don't even know where to start.
Let's start with that press conference, because if there's nothing else that we have learned about the Knicks over the last 5 to 10 years especially, it is that they don't do press conferences. They don't do access. They don't do accountability. They don't talk. Whether that's Steve Mills and Scott Perry, whether it was Phil Jackson, whether it was Glenn Grunwald, going all the way back to Donnie Walsh, who talked to us almost every day, a period that I lovingly called Glasnost, because it was the first time that the Knicks actually were accessible. Donnie Walsh and Mike D'Antoni came to New York and acted like their normal selves and operated the same way that they had with prior franchises where they were successful and talked to the media. Sometimes on the record, sometimes off, chit-chat, whatever, they were accessible. In this era, or every era since then, the Knicks, especially at the front office level, they hide. Ownership doesn't talk. GMs and presidents don't talk except when they have to. A couple times a year, preseason, maybe if they make a trade, maybe if they make a draft pick. Other than that, they're not checking in at all. Now, you might bump into them somewhere in a back hallway and have a conversation, and they do that. They don't talk on the record. They're not accessible. They don't talk about – the Knicks were the only team in the NBA. Let me point this out. The only team in the NBA that did not have a single president, GM, or head coach address the media in a meaningful way during the entire 2019, getting ahead of myself, offseason. They struck out. They issued a bizarre statement on June 30th. They did not talk the entire summer. So this is not a group that is usually compelled to speak publicly unless they are
compelled. Unless they're compelled.
Yeah. So I'm going to assume with a very high degree of certainty that Steve Mills and Scott Perry spoke the other night because Jim Dolan had one of his meltdowns and told them, go do something. Go say something.
Yeah, I think all the reporting has indicated that. All the reporting I've done has indicated that that was a JD and the Straight Shot production.
It needed a musical accompaniment.
And so for years and years and years, I would utter this phrase, you would utter this phrase, Knicks fans would utter this phrase, can we just be a normal team?
Yeah.
And that usually meant instead of trading a future first-round pick for Andrea Bargnani, who everybody knew was bad, It wasn't like he was still frisky at that point. He was bad. Yeah. He's a bad basketball player. Be normal meant, how about we stockpile draft picks? How about we don't throw ourselves at every fourth-tier star free agent who's going to put us in cap prison? How about instead of using the amnesty provision on Chauncey Billups in some sort of bizarre move when we could have just waived him instead of guaranteeing his contract X days before, we use it on Amari Stoudemire, who was broken. And to the Knicks' credit, they started to do stuff like that under the Phil Jackson regime, which I think largely did a bad job. But they would acquire extra second-round picks here or there. They would acquire extra assets here
and
there.
And didn't trade any away. Well, give credit – if nothing else, give Phil Jackson credit for one thing under his administration, however long it lasted.
Only meaningful – like, and by meaningful, I mean moves the needle, changes your life, changes your franchise. The only one of those they got, everybody went out of their way to immediately alienate by talking publicly about maybe trading him and taking what they did with Porzingis, who was not blameless by any means in what ended up being what did Gwyneth Paltrow call it? A conscious uncoupling. I think Kristaps Porzingis and the Knicks had a conscious uncoupling. That was how she wants to rebrand divorce. It's a conscious uncoupling.
Sounds nice.
So here's what a normal team does. A normal team on June 30th, after not getting Kevin Durant and Kyrie Irving, 3 months after your owner essentially told the world, we are getting Kevin Durant and Kyrie Irving, without saying those names, you don't release a statement. Now, notably, that statement was not an apology. It was framed by us as an apology, us the media. If you read it, it just says, we understand why some Knicks fans are disappointed. We remain excited about blah, blah. Wasn't an apology. Even if it felt like one, it wasn't an apology. But a normal team doesn't do that. A normal team is just like, yeah, we say nothing. We just go out and recover and do our job. A normal team, when you're 2-8, you just say nothing. You just say nothing. You get in your foxhole. You figure out a way to make it work or not make it, where you have meetings about what do we do if this continues? What's the trade? But you don't send those guys out to the media because you look like idiots. And by the way, that statement may not have been an apology, but because it read like one, guess what? The statement you shouldn't have made on June 30th, we get to throw it back in your face every time you say we had a successful summer. We got the guys we wanted. No, you release this just say, like, David Griffin, what are the Pelicans, 2-8, something like that? Griff is not holding press conferences reassuring the fans. You know, it's like
even if you think that that's an appropriate response, and sometimes it is, sometimes it's called for. You don't do it 10 games into a season. It sounds panicky. It looks panicky. It sends the wrong message. It sets the wrong tone. Look at what the coverage has been every day since then. Everything is about Fizdale is on the verge of being fired. They telegraphed panic. They telegraphed complete just panic. All it did was raise the temperature. And what you should do in that kind of situation, if you have any hope of getting out of this, is to tamp down the temperature. Don't raise it. But that's what happens when you have a tempestuous owner as Jim Dolan is. And so I should take this moment to make this point because it comes up all the time. Knicks fans who are still kind of clinging to the idea that they have figured it out, that they are doing things differently, that Jim Dolan has finally gotten out of the way and is not meddling anymore. This is meddling, folks. When you call your president and GM in at halftime and ream them behind closed doors and then send them out at the 10-game mark to try to calm the waters, but instead actually roil the waters more. That is meddling. That is an owner who is still screwing with basketball ops. And there are a bunch of other things I could get into about why Dolan should never be absolved. Everything that goes on still goes back to him. Do not try to tell me that he's not still their core problem.
And to your point, what do you think the players in the league are doing when Steve Mills and Scott Perry give that press conference? When Scott Perry looks like he would rather literally suffer diarrhea to give him an excuse to run to the bathroom in the middle of the press conference.
It was a hostage video. All it was missing was a little sign that said help code in coded language.
The rest of the players, the people you are reportedly trying to court to come play on your team, are doing the same things we're doing.
Yeah.
They're laughing. They're watching Twitter. They're looking at all the funny memes that are going and the jokes. They're doing, and this is, you know, Durant came out and said the Knicks aren't cool. Like the players, just like you and I, are like, what is wrong? What is this circus that's happening? The players are doing the same thing.
I had Matt Barnes and Steven Jackson, who have their own very cool podcast now going on Showtime. They came on my podcast last week and I want to say unprompted. I said, you guys were in the league for a long time. Give me your best and worst franchises. I was not trying to set them up, by the way, to bash the Knicks, but that's, where it went for both of them. They both listed the Knicks and they both pointed to ownership as the primary cause. Enes Kanter, of course, we know how he feels about it. He was on my podcast, a month or so ago. He said that's the reason that they didn't get free agents this summer. Kevin Durant, without saying it, kind of said it. I mean, he didn't point to Dolan specifically, but he said, we have all the evidence in the world to show that this is not just some media creation. This is not about us. This is about that people have learned, players, coaches, the agents who represent the most important players, they understand. They know the deal. And there was a time when maybe you'd let that slide because, you know what, I really want to be in New York, or I want to be in this market, or I want to be part of this historic franchise. That's not important enough anymore. What we saw this summer with the Clippers and the Nets was you could be that forgotten step sibling in the market that gets, 1/50th of the coverage and the attention and the fan devotion. But if you're doing things right, players entrust you with their careers in a way that they may not.
You know what players don't want to do? They don't want to, after a game, answer questions about an impromptu press conference that they didn't even see because it's going on while they're all in the shower. That's what they don't want to do. I don't know what the timetable on David Fizdale's potential firing was. If you told me if they lose to Dallas tonight, he's fired by the end of the night, I wouldn't be shocked. If you told me they give him a couple more weeks, if things are still going badly, maybe they turn it around. Maybe the Knicks go against expectations and win tonight. I don't know. How would you evaluate his performance? Whose fault is this and where are we going?
Whose fault is it that the Knicks are where they are, or that Porzingis is in Dallas?
Everything.
that the
2019. What I meant was that the 2019-20 Knicks don't appear to be very good. Yeah. And linked to that is that the guy who was supposed to be their franchise player is not on their team.
Well, let's start with this. Nobody should have expected them to be good this season. I don't know anybody expected them to be good.
There were internal expectations that they would be competitive.
When you
say competitive to me, when front office people say competitive to me, competitive but like East competitive, my interpretation, and I think this would be, I bet the Knicks brass would have agreed with this, like frisky 35 win team, something like that. I don't think competitive meant 45 wins, 40 wins, whatever.
Yeah, no, most of us, I think, expected they were going to be somewhere in the mid-20s, right? So that would be a jump from 17 to the maybe 25. Maybe if things really break right, 28, 30. But 35 would have been an extreme stretch in my book. And if you look at the computer models, if you look at the Vegas over-unders, anything else, they were all in that range. I mean, they were all in that somewhere like 26 to 28. That they are not quite on that pace early on in a season where they changed out a bunch of pieces and they've had some other injury and stuff. What like if they were a normal franchise that didn't have all the baggage carried in, you would just say, they're stumbling out of the gate a little bit. Like no one's worried about the Pelicans. I mean, I don't think they are.
Well, the Pelicans have Zion. That helps.
Pelicans have Zion. Yes, but also they've had some other bumps along the way early going here and they've got a lot of new pieces. And so normally you would look at all the context and say, let's not panic. I'm not even sure the Knicks should panic. And I say that as somebody who obviously didn't have high expectations for them, and I think they could still be and probably will be better than they've been. So that's why you don't start firing off flare guns at the 10-game mark. I still think they're probably better than what they've shown.
By the way, I agree. I think they're better than what they've shown.
Competitive means you're not getting blown out, right? Competitive means that if you were 2-8, you were at least a couple of bounces away from being 5-5. You're not losing in blowouts. You look competitive. You look like a team that's got it together, that has a plan, that is rowing in the same direction, that is giving its all. No, they haven't shown that. So I think the bigger concern than the record is, do they look like they actually have a plan and that they're executing it, and that this team actually does want to be competitive? I think there are some serious concerns there potentially. But again, it's really early to be panicking about that. Whose fault? I mean, look, this goes to another one of these alibis that has now been trotted out there by a certain part of Knicks fandom, or and probably from the Knicks themselves, trying to rationalize where they are and rationalize the Porzingis trade. And it partially goes like this. We're rebuilding. We did the right thing. We cleared cap room. We got extra picks. Other teams do that and you praise them. How come we're not getting that praise? Well, I'll tell you why. Because your rebuilding started like 5 or 6 years ago. And the payoff for rebuilding is high draft picks. You lose, you get high picks, and you hope that you strike gold on one of them. Well, the Knicks did. They got Porzingis. Now, I get it. He tore his ACL. And at the time they traded him, he hadn't played in a year. But you got the payoff for the teardown or for the rebuilding. You had the guy to build around, or at least a guy who was young, had made an all-star team, and could be an attractive piece that a Kevin Durant or a Kyrie Irving or other guys might want to come play with. And you sacrificed him to offload bad salary that you yourself put on the books. It's not the right use of that incredible asset. He was a top 20 player at the time he went down, top 20, top 25. And he might still be again. You can't say this is year one of a rebuild. They've been rebuilding in perpetuity ever since that 54-win season in 2012-2013. And part of the problem when you say, well, how did they get here? Why are they in this position? Look at what they've done since then, bouncing from Donnie Walsh to Glenn Grunwald to Steve Mills to Phil Jackson to back to Steve Mills. That's all just since the 54-win season. I mean, that alone. Coaching, you've now gone from Mike Woodson to, I guess, to Derek Fisher to Kurt Rambis to Jeff Hornacek to David Fizdale. I'm surprised Herb Williams didn't come back in there somewhere. It used to be that you'd get a Herb Williams game in a couple of weeks, couple of months. And along the way, here's what they did draft-wise. You brought up Bargnani earlier. I'm glad you did. So the year after they went 54, they crashed to 37. The 54-win season
was completely predictable.
Yes.
Completely predictable.
Right.
Now, I didn't think it was necessarily going to be that bad, but it was – and I have the receipts on this one. It was very predictable that 13-14 Knicks would take a huge step back.
Because in large parts, they hit so much of their success in that 54-win season was tied to some of the veterans they brought in, chiefly Jason Kidd, but also Rasheed Wallace, Kurt Thomas, Marcus Camby, Pablo Prigioni. Like everything was about these older dudes who didn't have a lot of miles left, not to mention career years from a couple of guys. Anyway, they crashed to 37 wins. And so in the 2014, at the end of that 2013-2014 season, you should get the payoff of crashing and burning, but you don't. Why? They didn't have their 2014 first-round pick. That was the final payment in the Carmelo Anthony trade. So they didn't have a pick there. The next year, they dropped to 17 wins, and they get Porzingis. The next year, they win 32 games, and they're in the lottery again, but they don't have a draft pick. Why? Our friend Andrea Bargnani and that trade. A trade, by the way, made by Jim Dolan, as the Carmelo Anthony was ultimately. He hijacked that trade from Donnie Walsh. He hijacked the Bargnani thing, or he's the one who pushed that through over Glenn Grunwald's objections. I've reported this in the past. I've cited it before. That's a thing. So they have no pick that year. So the year after they get Porzingis, they don't get another pick to try to pair with him. It would have been the number 9 pick. The Raptors end up with it and take Jakob Poeltl. However, guys who are still on the board, I'm going to play this game. Domantas Sabonis, DeJounte Murray. Oh, and Pascal Siakam.
can I just take a second? I am the driver of the Pascal Siakam bandwagon. What he is doing is beyond the imagination of the driver of the Pascal Siakam bandwagon. Last night in the fourth quarter in Portland, against a Portland team that's 4-8 and needs to start asking some hard questions, even though they've got a lot of injuries. He, I think, had maybe Kent Bazemore on him on a switch, backed it out towards half court, dribbled, kind of accelerated towards Kent Bazemore, decelerated, and popped an open three from the top of the arc and nailed it. And I'm like, this dude, Pascal Siakam is the greatest improvement story that I can remember in the NBA. He averaged 7 points a game 2 years ago. That's not like 5 years ago. That's 2 years ago.
Yeah.
He's averaging 27 points a game.
The acceleration of his improvement. I mean, I was thinking like Jimmy Butler comes in as a 30th pick and his first 3 years averages like 5.3 points or something. And Jimmy Butler makes some, you know, massive leap to all NBA. But I don't know if it was as sudden and as spectacular.
I don't want to go through the list of the blunders. I don't want to do that.
Then Ntilikina and then Knox and then so anyway they haven't nailed, so they've been to the lottery most years, the years that they actually had their pick, but they missed two picks they just didn't have. Other years they have not nailed it. And that's what happens. If you are, look at the Orlando Magic for years. Look at the Sacramento Kings for years. If you are perpetually bad and then draft poorly and don't make any other smart moves along the way, this is where you end up. You don't end up having guys around. And so a guy like Porzingis looks around, and of all the other reasons why he might have wanted out, he probably looks around and says, well, where's the hope here? Where are we going? And
let me be as clear as I can. The fault for the 2019-20 Knicks being bad, if they end up being bad, lies mostly with the front office who made the choices of the players that are on the team.
Absolutely.
Everything that people warned about came to fruition. They signed too many big men. They don't have enough shooting. Their offense is clunky, and yada. And Julius
Randle. And they have no point guard.
Julius Randle is a hog, and they have no point guard. That said, and this podcast will now work as an if David Fizdale is fired tonight ex post facto podcast. I have no idea what David Fizdale stands for as a head coach. I know in Memphis he stood for, we're going to modernize this offense, we're going to shoot more threes, and that because I think more personal relationships with some of the key players, or at least one key player, Marc Gasol, that went poorly. This Knicks team, between last season and this season, I have no idea what he's trying to do. I have no idea how he wants to play. They change the defensive scheme constantly. Every five games they're playing a new defense. Or, you know, they make tweaks here or there, which is fine. But, like, you got – offensively, I just don't know what they are. And you can tell me that, well, what is he supposed to do? He's supposed to make beef stroganoff, and you gave him whatever you gave him. Not the ingredients for beef stroganoff. I don't even know what beef stroganoff is.
Something with gravy. And
I'm sympathetic to that. But you know what? Part of a coach's job is to find an identity – even when the pieces don't mix. There have been coaches who were given rosters that at the beginning of every season we thought, ooh, that's not a good looking roster. And they say, you know what? We're leaning all in on this direction. Dave Yeager last year, no one thought the Kings were going to be good last year. Dave Yeager, who played slow down bully ball his entire NBA head coaching career, looked at De'Aaron Fox and said, I'm all in. We're going all in on that. We're going to play fast. I don't know if it's going to work, but that's going to be our identity. We could cite other coaches who were given mediocre to bad rosters and said, rise or fall, succeed or fail, that's going to be how we play. And that's part of a coach's job. And David Fizdale has failed to do that, and the Knicks are worse off as a result. But the first person to be blamed, the first head to fall, should not be the coach, because this roster was misshapen in ways that we all anticipated it was.
Yes. And I would just say that when we talk about, you know, coach has all these different responsibilities, right? There's all these different ways we can evaluate a coach. And some are harder to evaluate than others because there's so much that goes on that we do not see at all. But one fair way to evaluate a coach, especially the coach of a young rebuilding type team or whatever, is, are they establishing some sort of identity? Do you know what they're about? When Brett Brown got to the Sixers and they were doing the process, which was the most, you know, premeditated, stretched out, tear down whatever what we've seen, we at least knew along the way that they were going to be an up-tempo team. They were going to try to run a modern offense. They were going to, you know, look for shots at the basket and threes. When Kenny Atkinson took over the Nets, you saw the outline of an identity immediately, and guys overachieved and they won more games than expected, and you kind of knew what they were about. And you heard people around the league, even the Sixers during the process, you heard people around the league, it's, you know what, I can see the outline of what they're building. They don't have the talent to pull it off, and it was the same thing with the Nets. They don't have the talent to do this well, but I can see what their goals are, what their mission is as a team, offensively and defensively. And no, in a year plus, 90-something games now, we don't know what David Fizdale's what identity he's trying to instill in this team is or what their plan is, and that is a problem. But I agree with you. he's not the reason that they're bad. They're bad because they went not just all in on getting stars. They went all in on the idea that they were so sure they were going to get the stars and that that would fix everything and make up for all their past errors, all their past sins, that they were willing to sacrifice the best player on their roster to do it.
Now, let's look at things a little dispassionately. RJ Barrett is good.
Yes.
RJ Barrett is going to be a good NBA player.
Yes.
Perhaps a very good NBA player. Mitchell Robinson is good. If he can get his fundamentals a little better and stay on the floor, not foul all the time, he's going to be a very good NBA player. That's two. Kevin Knox is better this season. Kevin Knox looks on track to be something. I don't know what it is, but he does not look like the utter catastrophe that he was last year. And by the way, Knicks fans who think I'm too critical of the team, listen to what I said about Kevin Knox last year. I said many times the way he is struggling is exactly what I would expect from a 19-year-old kid playing his position in the NBA. And I was not at all discouraged by it. I'm encouraged by what I've seen this year. Ntilikina, I think, has become wildly overrated by Knicks fans because every time he does anything, they all start salivating. I don't think Ntilikina is a point guard in the NBA. I don't think Ntilikina is a starting point guard in the NBA. I don't think he's demonstrated outside of flashes here, there, France, FIBA, wherever, that he is a capable offensive player. Defensively, he's a beast. Offensively, it's not working. I don't think he looks like a starting NBA point guard right now. Could be useful. Dennis Smith Jr. is lost until further notice. Who am I forgetting? Is that it? That's everybody.
For the young guys that you're hoping to build around.
So yeah. Barrett, Robinson, Knox is interesting. They will have another high pick in this draft. That's interesting. As interesting as I think Barrett is, I don't think he profiles as a number one guy in the NBA. I don't think he's going to be quite that good. The shooting, the free throw shooting makes me nervous. I think he'll be a very good player. What I'm saying is all of that needs a tentpole. All of those players, even if they hit their ceilings, are going to need a fulcrum that defines what their roles are, that defines how the franchise plays. And the Knicks do not have that. By the way, that's not a sin. That's the hardest sin to get in the NBA. The most likely path to it is usually, for most teams, a high draft pick. But the Knicks banked on free agency. It didn't work out. But I do think they have some interesting young players. I just don't think they have something that brings it all together. And by the way, also in their somewhat defense, I think it's on the table. I don't know what's going to happen to Kristaps Porzingis. This is a rehab year largely for him. If he struggles all season, I'm not going to read much into it. Okay, but he's shooting 40%. He looks okay. Kristaps Porzingis looks okay. Again, let me be clear. I think this is a rehab year for him. I think the way he plays this year will be the minimum, should be, if he stays healthy, the minimal baseline quality of play for his prime. That said, there's a universe where there are many universes where in like 5 or 6 years, we look at Kristaps Porzingis and say, it's not awful that the Knicks traded him. It didn't work out the way it looked like it was going to work out. I don't know what's going to happen, but given his level of play this season, his health issues, his body and all that, I don't think it's like a lock that Kristaps Porzingis is a star for his entire career. I think, again, given that he didn't play for 19, 20 months, I'm fine with how he's playing right now. It's just not great. Like, I think every time he has a good game, it's just going to blare on Knicks Twitter. But Porzingis 28-12. There haven't been that many great games this year. Maybe no. They'll be what Dan Wall wants to have one tonight.
Yeah. No, and you know, the context for him is, of course, that you got to go back. Look at what Zach LaVine looked like when he came back from the ACL, Derrick Rose from his ACL.
Rehab,
anybody. Yeah, it's, you know, Gordon Hayward back from his ankle,
next year's the year.
Yeah.
If he looks next year like just a pretty good player, then this discussion veers a little bit into an interesting direction.
Our judgment of trades always evolves as it goes, right? Like there's day one, we make the snap judgments, everybody issues their grades, which, you know, most of us loathe doing, but you do it anyway because you do it on the merits, on what it looks like at that moment. Was this wise? Did they get enough? Did this team extract enough for this guy? All this stuff. And then it evolves as it goes, right? And yeah, it could look a lot different a year from now, 2 years from now, 3 years from now, especially if maybe Dennis Smith Jr. figures it all out. Maybe the Mavericks crash and burn and those picks turn out to be good, but chances are those picks are going to be mid to late first rounders. And those are not easy to just ace.
And chances are, you just said it, chances are Maybe. We'll see. Probably.
Yeah, we'll see.
Probably.
Luka enough is going to make them a very competitive team. And if Porzingis is even 80% of what he was before his ACL, and the Mavericks do a good job of putting guys around them, they're going to be competitive. Yeah. They're not going to be crappy enough for those picks to be super valuable. My main issue with the trade, there's multiple things, but here's a couple of them. One is, I don't buy that they had to do it at that moment.
Of course they didn't. This idea that Kristaps Porzingis was going to sign his qualifying offer if the Knicks had kept him is ridiculous. He floated the same threat when the Mavericks traded for him. And guess what happened? He signed a max deal the minute they put it in front of his face.
So, first of all, the Knicks are the ones who decided not to offer him an extension and thus make him, put him in the position of being able to be a restricted free agent or to potentially sign a qualifying offer that he wasn't going to sign. So, you know, it's on the Knicks that they did not extend him. Probably among the reasons that he was pissed off and wanted out, by the way. So they put themselves in a position to have alienated him, one. Two, they didn't have to trade him when they did. Three, even if you decided you should trade him at that moment, you didn't have to use him as bait to offload bad contracts. That's a choice you made. There are any number of ways to configure a trade in this league. If you're going to tell a team you have to take our bad contracts, well, then that is part of the payment. And it is part of the payment you're getting. You're getting the benefit of getting rid of those contracts. Well, other things could have been in there instead. If you weren't insisting on offloading Tim Hardaway Jr. and Courtney Lee to Dallas or whoever else, you might have gotten more picks. You might have gotten players that could actually play for you or stick around instead of two vets who walked and a young player who, even before Dennis Smith Jr. became a Knick, there were plenty of people around the NBA who were already off Dennis Smith Jr., including the Dallas Mavericks, who had been trying desperately to offload him. So you could have gotten a better deal if you decided you had to trade him. Now, again, you said it, and I agree, Zach. There is a universe or multiple universes where this trade looks a lot better for the Knicks in another year.
Not
or
even
two,
a lot better, but just less painful is
yes,
what I
it
would
may
say.
Not, it may not haunt them. If
less less right. unrequited love.
No, just less, yeah.
Less wanderlust for what could have been.
Right. And there's also a universe in which he returns to his old form and he and Luka dominate for the next 10 years as this phenomenal 1-2 punch. But they may come out of it okay. I will still say that doesn't justify the return package they got on the day that they traded him. They could have done better if they weren't insisting on offloading contracts that were a deal that was predicated entirely on a belief that they needed that cap room for two guys who never came.
Enough Knicks. Let's go on to talk about two major early season stories. And I want to see your temperature on them. Howard Beck of Bleacher Report of Brooklyn. Do you
of Carroll Gardens now, not even
you,
of Park Slope anymore.
Do you believe in Andrew Wiggins?
I think I do. I don't want to get taken for a ride here. I don't want, but you know what? I was watching them last night. He looks like a different player. Not just shot selection, not just aggression going to the hoop, not just defensive attentiveness. He's smiling a lot. Like, he looks happy. He looks comfortable. Like, they
don't say the word joy. Don't you dare say joy.
I said happy and comfortable.
Okay, don't say joy.
No, why are we striking joy?
Because joy is like culture. It's too much. It's been said too much.
Fair. I mean, I'm not buying, okay, we look across the board and then in points, rebounds, assists, effective field goal percent, like, they're all career highs. Those are all good. As J.E. Skeets pointed out in a tweet, there was like an 11-game span. I jotted it down. He tweeted this last night. There was an 11-game span, the first 11 games of 2016-17, when he was averaging 27 points a game with splits of 49, 52, 75. And so he was basically saying,
that's
like,
Canada on Canada violence right there. Skepticism of Andrew Wiggins from Skeets is, I expected Canadian propaganda.
That was like, it was his Roger Daltrey won't get fooled again tweet. I'm going old school. So, I get that. I get the cautious, like, pump the brakes, even in Canada. But the Timberwolves look like a team that is, can I say enjoying? Because there's joy is in the middle of enjoying.
Yeah, sure.
All right. They're enjoying who they are. There seems to be a palpable connection between Ryan Saunders and this young group. They've got good players around him. I like what they're doing with all these long wings with Covington and Culver and Wiggins. You know, there's two kinds of underachieving when you're a young player in this league, right? Or two kinds of is this guy going to be better than he's playing right now? Can he pull out of this? If you're a guy who has the talent, but you just don't know what to do with it, that was where Wiggins was trending, right? All this natural athleticism and size and ability, and he was hyped from the time he was like 15 years old or 13, whatever. The makeup was all there, and then it was all like, well, do you know what to do with it? And then there are the guys who just, they may not have it. They'll either never learn to shoot, or they'll never have the athleticism or the whatever. Wiggins already had all the other stuff that you need, and it was just a matter of putting it together right, or channeling it in the right direction, making smarter decisions with the ball, taking better shots. And that's what he's doing right now. So is this sustainable? Yeah. If you've cut out a ton of your mid-range and you're attacking more, you're driving more. I looked some of this up. He's like 23rd in the NBA right now in drives per game at 13.8 a game. He was at 7.9 per game and 69th last year. So he's driving more. I don't think he's getting more free throw attempts as a result, but he's taking the ball toward the rack more often. And if you look at his splits in terms of where he's shooting from, he's way down in the 16 feet to the 3-point arc. He's way down in 10 to 16 feet. Like, he's making smarter decisions with the ball. And so, yeah, that's sustainable. Just don't revert to old bad habits.
The thing that I'm most curious about is the playmaking, because this boon and assists, he's up to 3.6 per game for the season. He's like five and a half in this last five, six games, whatever it is. It's the best playmaking he's ever done. The Wolves going four out, and really five out if you include Towns, has made playmaking much easier for everybody because the reads are just easier. There's no bodies cluttering the lane. The easiest assist to get in the NBA is dribble around a pick, get like north of the foul line, kick out to an open shooter. That guy makes a shot. That's good. It's just not that. It's not, by NBA standards, not like advanced playmaking. He's getting a lot of assists like that. And he also racked up these assists until last night with Teague and Napier both hurt, and he was kind of the de facto point guard. That's like a perfect storm of you are going to pile up assists. By the way, some of these assists, I went back and watched just because I'd seen the Wolves' last three games. I didn't see last night, so I was like, oh, let me watch Wiggins' ball screens and assists. He got an assist. I wonder what happens to these assists. He got an assist, and I checked the play-by-play log. It was logged as an assist. He entered the ball to Noah Vonleh in the post. Noah Vonleh dribbled five times and made a jump hook, and Andrew Wiggins got an assist. I assume that those are just like quietly rescinded, and we never hear about it, because that's not an assist. That's just a different – there's probably one of those.
By the way, that stuff goes on a lot in this league. Somebody else was pointing one of these out with
LeBron
another team
has had
recently.
Some. LeBron has had some. But like, everyone has some. But this one was like especially egregious. Yeah. You and I could have thrown this pass.
I will also just say, though, there was at least one play last night, maybe two, where Wiggins was threading the needle and like really nice passes. Not just the kick out to the open shooter, but like – on the move, guy cutting toward the basket kind of stuff.
To me, the biggest change has been, and they're all linked together, his handle is better. And you can see he has like a little nifty in-and-out dribble where he uses it to both throw his own defender off balance before going around a pick so he gets an even bigger head start, or sends that guy like smacking right into a pick, or the big guy dropping on the pick and roll, he'll just get right around him with a little in-and-out dribble and go to the rim. His handle's better, and because his handle's better, he's setting himself up to have more space to drive and easier and more passes available to him. That's legitimate. I do think he's a little craftier. He has a little more change of pace. Like, it's not close to elite, but sometimes he'll slow down with the ball, almost get his defender on his back and like scan around a little bit, which he never used to do. Now, most of the time he's still taking floaters out of that, which is fine. And so he's making mostly paint by number passes with some of more advanced like slingshot to the corner that he already would do every once in a while. Even like bad Andrew Wiggins would do something on a pick and roll and be like, oh my God, I want that player. What? Where's that guy? Why doesn't he show up? So he's definitely craftier. I just want to see if the passing really sustains. I think it will for sure sustain, and the four-out system helps this too. He's just going to the rim, as you said. Like, he's just not taking mid-range shots hardly anymore. And he's not particularly artful going to the rim, but he's super athletic. And so he just, like, when he sees a big guy backpedaling or just standing there, he just kind of goes at him and jumps, and, like, his elbows are in front of his face, and, like, some stuff happens and the ball goes in. It's not particularly graceful, but it's working. He's I guess I'm somewhere in the middle where, like, he's demonstrably better. Like, this isn't just a fluke 10, 11 games. He's a better basketball player. He's a craftier, smarter basketball player. I'm not ready to say he's, like, completely reinvented and is whatever people, the most optimistic projection is. I'm not quite there yet. But he's better, and I'm interested.
Yeah.
I'm interested now.
For sure. Especially because he was on that track of, you know, comes into the league with supreme amount of hype. Again, he was a guy who was on the cover of, I think, ESPN Magazine and SI when he was 15, whatever. He comes in, he's supposed to be the next LeBron or the next somebody. You're the number one overall pick, and you put up numbers, and there's a certain amount of hype that goes with that, and it's, well, he's not that efficient. Nah, it's fine. It'll get better over time. And then 2, 3, 4 years in, and especially with all the different ways we have of breaking down a player now with analytics and tracking and everything else, and you start to say, he seems like kind of an empty numbers guy, empty calories guy, and then it sticks. And he's in his sixth year, and, you know, he's 24. He'll turn 25 in February. He's still young enough that a light bulb or two can go on. But when you're 6 years in, people start to think that this is just who you are. And guys have it click in at different stages. And when you were the number one overall pick with all the scrutiny that goes with that and all the expectations and the contract, that is a much harder thing to overcome. And I love nothing more than a good redemption story. And so if a guy is on the verge of is flirting with, you know, because he's the number one pick, you start having the bust word thrown around. If you're flirting with that and pull back from the edge and have the light bulbs go on and play a better, smarter version of yourself, you don't have to become the next LeBron or the next anybody else, but he could become an all-star still. He could become a really, really good player in this league, and that alone, I think, is a great story.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see how he looks with Teague back full time, and just sort of what is he on a really good team? That's a question that I don't think is answered this year. Like, what is he? We have to see how he sustains. But, like, when he's not on a really good team, he's not gonna have the ball in his hands this much. He may end up having it this much on this team because Jeff Teague's not very good anymore. But that touches on, he's shooting 36% from three and looks more comfortable. Is that real? Is he going to commit to being at least an average defender, which he's been this year? If that's real and you have better ball handling and a better feel for the game, that's an interesting player on a good team. I don't think he will ever be like an advanced playmaker. Like, I don't think he'll ever be a guy who hits the roll man with like really artful passes. I don't think he will ever advance to the point where it's like he's manipulating, he's anticipating and manipulating the defense and making the passes you don't expect, like, right, regularly. I think he'll be good at making the passes that you mostly expect. I don't see him advancing to that level as a playmaker. And if he doesn't advance that level as a playmaker, I just sort of wonder what his place in like a 55-win ecosystem is, but he's demonstrably a better player.
I think his own evolution might be the difference between what he's doing on a bad team versus being on a good team, because he might be the key to them being a good team. Because Towns is already a stud,
and by the way, they're 7-4. They're, yeah, a good team now.
But the other thing is, here's the curiosity. I've especially as you mentioned, you know, Teague and everything else, and this is what I've started wondering in my own head the last few days. Does this team need, and should it still want, to trade for D'Angelo Russell? Because now you've got that primary ball handler and playmaker where Wiggins doesn't have to shoulder all that. However, D'Angelo Russell seems to be at his best, at least individually, when he just gets to control the ball a lot. So it's a really interesting question.
The other thing I wonder, because nobody knows him better than the people in that building, I wonder if some woebegone franchise called Gerson Rosas right now and was like,
buying high?
Whoa.
Yeah.
Here's an offer. Would he have the guts, the temerity?
Temerity is a good word.
To sell high on Andrew Wiggins, yeah, with all of this goodwill and all of this, like, the guy we got. We didn't draft him, but we essentially kind of almost did, right? Like, you know, we traded him. He never played a game for anyone else. I would love to be in the room if, like, Charlotte called and was like, PJ Washington, two future firsts, some matching salary. What do you think? I would love to be in that room.
That'd be a tough one. I mean, that's one of those ones where it comes down to.
I'm just making that up, to be clear.
But we and all NBA media and fans are having this discussion of is it real or an illusion? Are we buying or not on this is the new Andrew Wiggins and this is going to sustain and can it keep going? Can this trajectory keep going? But they have to, of course, have that same discussion there. And as you say, they know him better than anyone. So what is their level of belief that not only has he reached a new level that he can stay at, but that there is still other levels to go to? Because if they believe that, then you absolutely keep him. If you have any doubts, then yeah, you pawn him off on whatever sucker out there wanted to give you the best trade package. And teams would. There are teams that always, you know, they need that injection of life and excitement.
The Wolves have been confident in his trade value. I don't think it was ever a discussion we're selling low or we're paying to get off him. I think there's been a confidence that if and when, we'll get value. But I don't think I don't think they're having a conversation. I think they're thrilled. I think it's a happy story. Ryan Saunders, really, they have a great relationship. I think it's a wonderful story. Here's some Wiggins stats. Last 3 minutes of games within the last when the score is within three, he's 9 of 14 from the floor so far this year. Some tracking data. Last season, he ran 15 pick and rolls per 100 possessions. This year, 34. So that to the volume. About 1 point per possession when he shoots out of a pick and roll or passes to somebody who shoots immediately. That's pretty good. Broader points per possession when, like, on any trip that has him running a pick and roll is like almost 1.1. That's really good. He's passing way more often on the pick and roll this year by percentage. So, like, all very healthy signs for Andrew Wiggins. It's been a really fun story.
And again, of course these things are sustainable. All you have to do is keep making the better, smarter decisions that you've just shown us you have the ability to make. And I think they've got a group there in terms of coaching staff and organization that is going to keep coaxing him in that direction or giving him the right feedback. And I think there's every reason to believe that this can and should sustain.
People, do you ever feel like ticketing websites make getting to the event difficult on purpose? It's as if they're so big they can get away with not caring about the customer experience. With millions of live events and a price match guarantee, SeatGeek proves there's a better way. You can search for sports, live music, comedy, Broadway, and more. SeatGeek has the tickets you're looking for all in one place. They built the fastest way to find tickets, so you can stop searching the entire secondary market, 20 websites for the perfect seat, and start enjoying SeatGeek. SeatGeek pulls together millions of tickets from all over the web, and then it rates each deal on a scale of 1 to 10 and displays them on an interactive seat map that is super easy to read. Green dots mean good deals. Red dots, maybe a little overpriced. Every purchase is fully guaranteed, so you can shop for tickets with confidence. I have the SeatGeek app on my phone. I've used it to get tickets to Broadway and other stuff. It's by far the fastest and easiest way to buy tickets. And SeatGeek will even give you $10 off your first purchase. All you need to do is use our promo code. Download the SeatGeek app today and use promo code LOW, my last name, the name of this podcast. Bam, $10 off your first purchase. That's promo code LOW, L-O-W-E, for $10 off your first purchase with SeatGeek.
Second big development of the year that I haven't talked about much yet because we just talk about this team all the time. The Los Angeles Lakers are 9-2. With the second best net rating in the league. You know who has the first best, aka the best net rating in the league?
Best net rating in the league. If it's the Phoenix Suns, my head will explode.
Boston. By 1/10 of a point over the Lakers. Boston has the number one offense in the NBA very sneakily after putting up 140 on the Wizards, which apparently is just the thing you can do. You can roll out the Washington Generals if they had a little intra-city battle.
I'd watch that.
Generals Wizards.
Oh yeah. Sure.
The Generals might put up 140. Krusty the Clown his bet might finally pay off. The Lakers look really, really good in ways that I don't think people necessarily expected. They have the number one defense in the NBA, and they're making it work with their centers are giving them really good minutes. Those minutes I think will go down a little bit now that Kuzma's back, but they're getting between 30 and 40 really good minutes a night from Dwight and JaVale.
JaVale just did – like last night's line by JaVale. Was it like 22 and 12 and three blocks? Something like crazy.
It was crazy.
Yeah.
LeBron leads the league in assists for averaging 11, which is by far a career high. His chemistry with AD looks really good. What do you think of this team so far?
They're fun. They're I think they're pretty much what I expected. I mean, their defense is, I think, is better than everybody would have anticipated, given where they were last season. But I don't think there's anything that should be that surprising. Like, LeBron and AD were always a perfect 1-2 or 1-1 or 1A, 1B, whatever the hell they are. I'm not surprised that LeBron, despite all of his noise about it's all about AD, it's AD's team, whatever, like they're essentially kind of like neck and neck in usage or field goal attempts per game. Like it's LeBron is still the driving force of that team. And AD, of course, is really important, but I'm not surprised at that part of it. I, like a lot of people, wasn't sure about their guard core, wasn't sure about if they had enough shooting. They've been okay. They've been fine. I still think if you go to, like, I was looking at the career 3-point percentages for all their perimeter guys. It's not great. It's competent enough. It's not great.
Well, the interesting thing is they are, in terms of 3-point volume, only two teams have taken fewer threes than them as a percentage of shot attempts, San Antonio and Indiana, who are playing from a different decade. The Lakers need to be taking more threes than that. That's surprising for a LeBron team, and I know they're playing big and all of this, but for a LeBron team to take that few threes is very, very surprising.
Yeah. And yet they're effective anyway, I think, just because of you know, all the attention that either of those two guys draws. It's just giving everybody else so much room to operate. And also, LeBron and AD by themselves are almost impossible to stop.
And when LeBron and AD are on the floor, they're scoring at a rate that would be like second or third in the league among all teams. So, like, when their core guys are on the floor, they're scoring really, really well.
Yeah. It's... My question about them was never going to be about whether LeBron and AD were a good fit. Obviously, they were going to be great, and they are great. It was always going to be about the supporting cast, and it was always going to be about what happens when, as we are now, AD has some shoulder concerns, and LeBron is turning 35 next month, and at some point he's going to miss some games. Who are they when those guys aren't available? Now, you can play that game with every team that's built around a couple of top-level stars, but where I leaned, like a lot of people, toward the Clippers over the Lakers in preseason, you know, guesswork prognostications that we all do, like, they've got Lou Williams, and they've got this Lou Williams Montrezl Harrell thing that is its own entity that is completely separate and apart from and effective on its own, apart from Kawhi Leonard and Paul George. And the Lakers don't have that third guy that you could just say, go get us buckets. Just go get us 20, 25, maybe 30 on a night, especially if one of our guys is hurting or is having an off night. Like, LeBron had that game recently where he went at 10 or 11 points or something, still at a triple-double. They lost to whoever it was that night. But they don't have that other scorer. They don't have that other guy who could just step in and say, I got it tonight. So, you know... Long term, over the course of a season, that might haunt you at times, but there's still a team that when we get to April, May, and possibly June, you know, as long as LeBron and AD are healthy and playing the way they're playing, yeah, they're everything we thought they would be.
The Kuzma piece is going to be interesting because they have a lot of ways they can look. Like, they can put LeBron, Davis, and a traditional center, no Kuzma. They can go LeBron, Kuzma, Davis. They can go LeBron, Davis at center, no Kuzma, so three guards and those guys. It's going to be interesting to see how they integrate Rondo, because I do like the idea of when LeBron is out of the game and Davis is in the game, which should be their general rotation, right? They play a few minutes here and there where both of them are out. Like, I like Rondo and Caruso playing with Davis. Give him as much ball handling as possible so he doesn't have to do everything all the time. He can screen and dive like he's always done. But they just have a lot of different kind of identities now that they have their whole team back, and all of them look pretty crisp. And part of the reason is a lot of them involve LeBron and AD, and like, it's not that hard to look pretty crisp when you have those guys. And AD has just been like, when it's Bron and AD and one of Dwight and JaVale, it's not always pretty for Anthony Davis, like, because there's another big guy mucking up his space.
Yeah.
So when he posts up on the left block, someone's right over there on the right block, which means he's going to have to get to the rim fast through a very narrow corridor of space to get up there and finish. And you know what? He does, because that's what great players do. Great players screw up your defense. Great players take situations that are imperfect and make them work. And he is going turbo through those tight spaces, taking fouls, finishing. It's just been really, really impressive. I would like to see him space to the three-point line a little bit more when he's not – when he's either pick and popping, which he'll still do every once in a while, or when he's not in the play, like when he's when LeBron is running pick and roll with JaVale and Dwight, because he'll sometimes catch the ball and then dribble in to a 19-footer, which isn't great. But other than that, I mean, they look – if they can sustain this kind of play from their centers, that's been the biggest story to me of their season. If these guys – if they're really getting 30-whatever quality minutes a night from those guys, this is a this is a better team than even we anticipated. And I think we were both optimistic about the Lakers.
Yeah. The other thing is that I think there was some reasonable and then also some gratuitous, is it concern trolling about LeBron and his health and his ability to bounce back. I was never one who thought that last season meant that was the end of LeBron as we knew him. The injury knocked him out for whatever, 4 to 6 weeks, and he was never himself again. And also there was nothing to play for. So he puts up 27-8-8 anyway. And everybody says, but it's empty, and they didn't make the playoffs, and he stopped playing defense entirely. All right, fine. There was nothing to play for, and they had a really weird roster around him, and it was poorly built, and they've got a better group coming back, obviously, on Anthony Davis's addition alone. But LeBron James, even in year 17 and on the verge of his 35th birthday, is still killing people and is still able to control a game outright at all. And the reason they're, what would you say, number one defensively, two?
Number one defense over Utah.
He has a hell of a lot to do with that. He's still capable. Now, are we going to see that every night through the regular season? Probably not. It's probably not even wise for him to do that if he's expecting to play deep into June. But LeBron James is still, like I said it before the season started, I was really queasy about all the lists, and when I was asked by SiriusXM to do our own rankings of, like, who are you going to start a team with, I still put LeBron number one. Like, someone has to absolutely positively, like, he either has to fall off a cliff almost literally, or somebody has to definitively displace him before I'm ready to say LeBron James is not still the best player in the NBA.
Kawhi has also slowed down after a hot start and looks in some games, like, worn down. Already, his turnovers have gone way up. He's had a lot of bad shooting games that then become acceptable shooting games because he goes on these fourth quarter blitzes. And Kawhi, I mentioned him because he was sort of the consensus, like, that's the guy. If it's not LeBron, that's the guy. Maybe it's Giannis. I think how the conference finals unfolded last year, I think colored that discussion to shade it in Kawhi's direction. But LeBron has been really good. Can you just stop with the I'm not washed? Remember, people said I was washed. Maybe I belong in the cleaner. Whatever the jokes are, no one said you are washed, man.
What they said was you're number five instead of number one, which is a pretty big tumble for him. Like, for him, that's washed.
I guess in LeBron's mind, that's people saying he's washed. I guess in his defense, it's just like people were like, no, you got injured for the first time. Yeah. That's a little scary given your age and your minutes. Like, it's totally reasonable to expect small little declines every year until you decide to retire. Yeah. And that, by the way, LeBron could probably play till he's 45 if he wants.
And people like you and I would sit there and say, no, he's not quite who he was, but he's still amazing. But there certainly are a lot of people there who can't wait for that drop, that serious drop off the cliff to happen, who were, I don't know if people used the word washed, but people were very eager, I think, to see that happen. Or I think just concluded, and again, I kind of understand it. When his team misses the playoffs for the first time ever since his rookie year, and he looked at times like he did, and he missed a bunch of games because he finally got hurt, people are saying, well, like, look at all the miles, look at all the minutes, look at everything else. If they wanted to conclude that was probably the end of LeBron as we knew him, like, I kind of get it. I do think people were rushing to that too fast. I do think, yes, to your point, LeBron is overplaying that particular line of criticism so that he can, dunk on people figuratively.
He also still dunks on people. There, if there's one little blaring warning sign, not warning sign, warning sign is too strong. If there's one little thing just to watch with the Lakers, they're not getting to the line very much other than AD. They're like 26th or 27th.
LeBron's way down.
And their jump shooting outside of Danny Green has been really bad. So if you look at a little cleaning the glass, has their little shot charts from everywhere. They're second, they're shooting 71% at the rim. So that's blaring orange. Orange is good. Everywhere else is dark blue. 23rd on threes, 25 on non-corner threes, 27th on mid-range jumpers, 27th on floaters. They just, and Danny Green shooting 45% from three, because that's what Danny Green does. Apparently, you just roll him out there. He makes half his threes almost. And you know, they've been able to work around that so far. And maybe it's not a problem. Maybe it changes. Maybe LeBron's shooting ticks up. LeBron's not shooting it great. I think he's shooting 31% from three and not as well from two as usual by his, again, otherworldly standards. But the Lakers are really good, and the league is more fun when the Lakers are good, because everyone roots for them or against them really hard. The Lakers are just a show. They're a show unlike any other show in the league, and it's more fun when they're good. And they're really, really good. Anything else we didn't touch on?
Stroop waffles. We didn't touch on Stroop waffles.
Yeah, what happened? Robert Covington ate a Stroop waffle?
Was he playing? Fourth quarter, he's on the bench, and the camera panned by. He just happened to have this thing in his mouth, and I went, it's one of those weird phenomena in life, right? Where you discover something for the first time and suddenly it's everywhere. Like, we have those stupid Revel scooters now around New York. I didn't know that these things had come to New York, and somebody pointed out once, oh yeah, those obnoxious Revel scooters. I'm like, what are you talking about?
Oh no, those ones you can just hop on?
Yes. And all of a sudden, once I saw one of them, now I see them everywhere. So, last year we had good friends of ours in Brooklyn who had gone to, I think, Amsterdam, and they brought back these Stroop waffles, and it's like this little, it's like caramel filled, or you can fill it with other stuff, and it's like two waffles together with like, but like it's got a filling in there, right? And what you do, you take the Stroop waffle, you put it on top of your hot mug of coffee or tea or whatever, and it heats it up. So now it gets all nice and warm and gooey inside, whatever, and then you eat the Stroop waffle. I'd never heard of this. I just experienced it for the first time within the last year. And then suddenly I noticed, like, oh, like our bodega has the Stroop waffles. Well, that's dangerous. Suddenly Bleacher Report is like stocking them in our cafeteria. Now that's really dangerous because that stuff's free. And so now I'm watching the game last night and Robert Covington, I'm like, wait a minute. That's not, is it? So I tweeted about it and.
Controversy ensued.
Steph Bondi of the New York Daily News came back with, no, Stroop waffles suck. And, you know, the whole thing happened. But apparently, I've been informed by the Twitterverse and now by sources in the Twin Cities that there is something else. I can't remember the brand, but it's actually some sort of like energy bar version of the Stroop waffle. So it still looks like a Stroop waffle. I think it's probably got all the sugar of a Stroop waffle, but it's supposed to be somehow like your re-energizing athletic snack on the bench thing.
Okay.
Right up there with like whatever other stuff that's come out in the last several. So In his case, it was like an energy bar. It wasn't like the Stroop waffle like I got from Amsterdam.
Are people riding around these scooters in Brooklyn? Are adults riding around these scooters?
yes, they
are. I don't think.
I don't mean like the scooters. I mean like little moped things.
I understand.
The little light blue ones.
Oh, okay. I thought you meant like the electric
scooters
that look like
kids'
scooters,
things.
But bigger.
No, those things are all over San Francisco.
They're in LA.
New York has not allowed them yet. But
okay.
No, I'm talking about like the moped type scooter.
That's fine. I don't think an adult can look anything but silly on what is essentially a large child's scooter. I think helmet on, helmet off. I just think you look undignified and you shouldn't do it. Like, you've probably seen this in my neighborhood. There are so many parents and all the kids have their little scooters.
Yeah.
You get the adult scooters so that you can keep up. Just run.
Yeah.
Just run. You just look like a dope. On an adult scooter. It's just a tall scooter.
Yeah.
Like they're going to the grocery store and forget it, a Segway. You can't look anything but dumb.
Do people still ride Segways?
They do around Croatia. The tourists will go on Segway tours and inevitably they're jumbled so close together that there will be a Segway on Segway collision and they'll both topple over and I will laugh hysterically in their faces about that's what you get. You're riding in close proximity to other freaking Segway riders. And it makes a noise. Like they hit each other. It's noisy. They clatter. It's great.
At least the scooters take up less space on the sidewalk. So,
yeah.
But when we were in San Francisco, I think even for the finals, walking around, like there were just stretches of them were just like laying all over the place. Cause you just pick them up.
Yeah. You pick them up. You pay and you commute to work.
Yeah. No, but the ones I'm talking about, like this like little moped thing. And now these things are everywhere. They're the new scourge of New York.
I have not seen them in my neighborhood.
They're all over Brooklyn.
All right. It's time for the Porzingis Bowl.
Porzingapalooza.
Porzingapalooza. Howard Beck, you can read his work at Bleacher Report. His podcast is called The Full 48. Who was the guest this week?
My brain
must have been riveting. Must have just been
no. It was fantastic. No, it was God Sham God. I interviewed God.
Oh, God Sham God. That's right. I haven't listened to that one yet. Listen and read all Howard's stuff. Howard, enjoy the game, and I will see you soon.
Thank you, Zach.
The Low Post is presented by Goodyear. Drive always discovers possibilities. Goodyear, more driven.